Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be with you for the next 45 minutes or so while we talk about recent developments in the public safety labor world. I want to start by talking about a situation that's been brewing down in California that involves a conflict between a discrimination statute and some legislation passed under the name of police accountability. So let's take these apart. First of all, California has a statute that looks a lot like Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and prohibits discrimination in employment and more. It's called the California Fair Employment and Housing Act. I'll refer to it as FEHA. As I mentioned, it's a bit broader than Title VII is, has more protected classes, for example, applies to more than just employment. But think of it as a general anti-discrimination statute. In 2015, the California legislature passed something called the Racial Identity Profiling Act, the state was charged with regulations. The Department of Justice of California was charged with developing regulations that took effect on January 1, 2024. So what did those regulations say? And that's what's going to become so important here. Under the new regulations to the Racial Identity and Profiling Act, I'll call that RIPA. Under the new regulations for RIPA, officers who made stops, who encountered civilians on the job, had to complete a report that included a lot of different things about the individual who was stopped, but also about the officer himself or herself. And one of the things that the officer had to report about themselves was their identified gender. The state was generous. It gave people five choices as to gender. One, a cisgender man/boy. Two, cisgender woman/girl. Then there was transgender man/boy, transgender woman/girl, and non-binary. So the officer had to check one of those boxes. Now, where that has run into problems, beyond, you can imagine, all sorts of privacy claims that individual officers might have about that very sensitive information, where that runs into problem is with FEHA, the anti-discrimination law, because there are regulations under the FEHA, been so since 2017, that specifically prohibit employers from asking employees about their gender. So what's a law enforcement employer to do here? It's got an obligation to comply with both statutes, but FEHA explicitly says that an employer cannot require this sort of reporting that is mandated under RIPA. So in the end, what happened was a number of public safety unions banded together with employers and petitioned the state of California to rewrite the regulations. Who submitted this request? It was signed jointly by four entities, the Peace Officers Research Association of California, PORAC, the California Association of Highway Patrolmen. Those are the two on labor side. And then on the employer side, you had the California Police Chiefs Association and the California State Sheriffs Association. So here's the bottom line of what the letter petitioning the state had to say. And I'm going to quote from the conclusion of the letter. Very well done letter, by the way. Quote, while RIPA was enacted to address concerns of bias and discrimination through racial and identity profiling within law enforcement agencies. The mandatory gender self-identification regulation paradoxically forces the most vulnerable officers to disclose their gender identity to their public employers. We seek further review of this regulation before any peace officers are forced to disclose their gender. And the letter, the bottom line of the letter, employers are in, quote, an untenable position, end quote, because they will be confronted with, quote, the troublesome choice of whether to violate FEHA or RIPA, an untenable situation. Well, it appears that the Attorney General did not immediately put those regulations on hold. Different groups, including the group that I'm just talking about of employers and unions, went to court. And as of the last that I've heard, which is only a couple of weeks ago, courts have issued a temporary restraining order putting on hold the RIPA regulations. There's a moral to this story here, right? That when legislatures act, they ought to do so carefully, and they ought to do so with a defined purpose in mind, a defined purpose that the legislation is going to solve some sort of problem. And that really wasn't the case here. The legislation, RIPA, created a problem. How could the California legislature, of all legislatures in the country, have not realized that a rule that required officers to report their gender identity, one of the most private things a person has about themselves, how could the legislature not think that a statutory scheme that produced such a regulation was a terrible idea? I'm guessing those RIPA regulations are never going to be enforced, and that the mandatory reporting will be a thing of the past very quickly. Next up, we have a decision from the Florida Supreme Court on whether a victim's rights statute can be used to shield the names of officers who are the victims of crime. And this is a situation that arises out of Tallahassee, Florida, and it involved two different uses of deadly force by police officers. In the first case, a man rushed at a Tallahassee police officer with a hunting knife, and the officer defended himself by fatally shooting the assailant. 8 days later, a different Tallahassee officer responded to a crime in progress, very serious crime. The perpetrator had stabbed somebody else to death. And during the course of the encounter with the officer, the suspect aimed a gun at the officer. The officer defended himself by shooting the man, killing him. A grand jury took a look at each of the shootings and determined that in each case, the use of deadly force was lawful and justifiable. You'd think that might end it, except for, of course, the inevitable civil lawsuits that result from these situations. But it didn't end it. Reporters sought the disclosure of the officers' names from the city. The officers kind of intervened in that whole request and asserted that they qualified for protection under a victim's rights statute known as Marcy's Law, because they were the victim of assaults from which they had defended themselves. The city ended up not agreeing. The Officers' Labor Organization, the Police Benevolent Association, sued the city to prevent the disclosure of the names, and the case went all the way up to the Florida Supreme Court. So what does Marcy's Law say And what did the court have to say about that? Marcy's Law includes a list of victims' rights. And one of those rights that victims have is the right to prevent the disclosure of information or records that could be used to locate or harass the victim or the victim's family, or which could disclose confidential or sensitive information about the victim. So are these officers victims who qualify for that protection under Marcy's Law? Well, a victim is defined by the law as a person who suffers direct or threatened physical, psychological, or financial harm as the result of the commission or attempted commission of a crime. So sure, the officers are protected by this law. So where's the action going to be before the Florida Supreme Court? Whether the disclosure of the officers' names would fall under the definition in Marcy's Law that the information that is protected is information that could be used to locate or harass the victim or the victim's family. And the Florida Supreme Court said this is not the information that Marcy's Law was designed to protect. I'm going to quote from the court's opinion. Fairly read, the text of Marcy's Law does no such thing being protect against the disclosure of the names of the officers. For it is one thing to identify a person and another altogether to locate and harass him or her. To locate a person is to establish that he or she is in a certain place. Marcy's Law speaks only to the rights of victims to prevent the disclosure of information that could be used to locate or harass them or their families. Here it comes. One's name, standing alone, is not that kind of information or record. It communicates nothing about where the individual can be found and bothered. Really? A state Supreme Court is actually saying that a victim's name provides nothing about where the individual can be found or bothered? Maybe the Florida Supreme Court needs to be introduced to, what's the name of that program again? Google. And all the information that can be turned up with a simple Google search, no matter how much police officers try to keep private information about where they live and what their home phone numbers are and who their children are, no matter how much in the way of protections there might be from that sort of information under a state law, it's virtually impossible for any of us to shield where it is we live and how we can be communicated with from disclosure over the internet. And the Florida Supreme Court's opinion here doesn't mention a word about that. Let's go back to the court's opinion. The court said, look, if Marcy's Law did what the police said it or say it does, quote, it would raise serious doubt about how to square a victim's rights under Marcy's Law and a defendant's right to confront at trial adverse witnesses. Okay, that's right. When somebody is testifying, unless they are the deepest of confidential informants in the rarest of cases, the right to confront witnesses does include the right to know the name of the witnesses against you. But there's no criminal case going on here. Both of the individuals who assaulted the police officers died on the day they assaulted the police officers. The officers are not being prosecuted The assailants are not being prosecuted. Why in the world would the Florida Supreme Court base its decision on the notion of a criminal prosecution that is not involved in the case itself? And I think what the court was doing was just sending a message, don't bring us any arguments that the disclosure of the names of the victims of crime are somehow protected by this victim's rights statute. You can tell from the tone of my voice that I think this is a pretty terrible opinion. I think it's pretty terrible just from the standpoint of the legal reasoning that is involved and the failure of the court to consider the basics of Internet 101. But this is a state statute, Marzi's Law, which means the Florida State Supreme Court is the final and binding arbiter of what the law means. And the court, with this decision, shows, I think, a pretty clear signal that it intends not to keep police officer names private, under even if they are the victims of the most serious crimes. Next up, let's go over to Wisconsin and talk about the legality of a mandatory physical fitness test. We're starting to see a little bit of a spike in litigation over mandatory physical fitness tests, so I thought it'd be a good idea to find one of the recent cases that does a good job of explaining the law in the area. So mandatory physical fitness tests and public safety have over the years fairly frequently been subject to challenge under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, challenge on the basis of sex discrimination. And the reason for that is the results of mandatory physical fitness tests, whether they're given to applicants or given to existing employees, the results disproportionately favor men and disfavor women. And so lawsuits have been filed, many of them, saying these tests violate Title VII's prohibition against sex discrimination. So how do these cases go? Once they find their way into court, how are they litigated? Well, you start with the plaintiff, an applicant or an employee, saying, I'm in a protected class. It's not difficult in these sorts of cases. They're almost always women, and that's a protected class. If they prove they're in a protected class and they were denied an employment benefit, a job, or maybe they ended up getting fired for not meeting a minimum physical fitness requirement, if they were denied such a benefit, they could show the necessary adverse employment impact necessary to justify a Title VII case. That part of these cases is almost always easy. The person who's bringing the lawsuit, well, they wouldn't bring it if they weren't in a protected class, and they wouldn't be there unless there was some sort of adverse impact. The burden of proof then shifts over to the employer to show that it has a business necessity for whatever the standard might be that is being challenged. And if the employer can show that it has a business necessity, and that the test is job-related, then the burden of proof shifts back to the applicant or employee again to show that the employer's decision is a pretext for discrimination. And usually the pretext that is claimed in these sorts of cases is that there are other tests out there. The test for the business necessity, and those tests don't have the adverse impact on women. And therefore, you, employer, choosing to use the test that does have an adverse impact when there's this perfectly good other test out there that meets your business needs, that's sex discrimination. And that's the burden of proof that the employee typically stumbles on in these sorts of cases. Well, this case in Wisconsin involves a firefighter. She's a firefighter for Janesville, Wisconsin. Her name's Catherine Erdman, and she's been a firefighter for Janesville since 2007. But that's not where she really wants to work. She wants to go to work for the Madison Fire Department, a larger fire department, state capital, more interesting, higher paying, lots of reasons to go to work for Madison. Well, the Madison Fire Department has a two-stage application process, testing process. The first is you've got to pass a written exam. And if you pass the written exam, then you qualify for the physical fitness test. And it looks like the testing happens. It's not clear from the court's opinion. Looks like it happens every 2 years. Erdman failed the written test in 2006, 2008, 2010, 2012, and 2018. But in 2014, she managed to pass the written test, which meant she proceeds on to the physical fitness test. So what is the city's physical fitness test? Well, there's seven components of it, and I'm going to say them pretty quickly. The equipment shuttle, hose drag, sledgehammer, search, rescue, ladder, and pike pole. We're going to be focusing in this discussion on the pike pole. Many of you are very familiar with what a pike pole is, but just in case, a pike pole is a tool that's used by firefighters basically for the purposes of helping ventilating a fire. So picture a slender pole, usually about 4 to 12 feet in length, with some sort of metal hook on the end of it. And it can be used to poke holes in things and to, if need be, tear down sheetrock and the like. Back to Madison, Wisconsin's physical fitness test and how the pike pole plays a role in that. Well, Madison has seven different events, as I've mentioned. And in order to receive a passing score on the entire physical fitness test, applicants have to achieve a minimum score on each of the seven events. And they also have to achieve a higher, what's known as cut score, on at least five events. Erdman in 2014 achieved the cut score on five of the different events, and on the sixth did receive the minimum score, which means she passes if she can pass the pike pole event. Well, as you can guess from the fact that I'm talking about this at all, she did not. She was unable to achieve the minimum score and was disqualified for potential employment from the city. That year, the city's test was given to 471 men, 395 of whom passed, and given to 28 women, four of whom passed. All four women were hired. In 2014, that same year, this just by way of background statistics, 14% of the city's firefighters were women. That number had fallen to a little bit less than 11% in 2018. Those may seem like low numbers, 14%, 11%, but both figures are actually well above the national average, where we have about 4% of firefighters nationally who are women. Erdman sues under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, saying these scores, the disparate passing rate of men and women, indicate that there's sex discrimination going on with respect to the city's physical fitness test. There's a resolution of the case at the trial court level with the city prevailing, and Erdman appeals to the federal Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, you've heard me talk about the Seventh Circuit before. It's a court that I have thought of for many years as one of the best, if not the best, federal court in the country. The reasoning of the Seventh Circuit in cases is just simply consistently high. And that has continued over the years as the political composition of the court has changed depending upon what party the president is in. This is a good court to be hearing a question about the legality of a mandatory physical fitness test. So the court applies the different tests under Title VII. Test one, is Erdman in a protected class? Of course she is. She's a woman. And is there an adverse employment impact? Of course there is. She was denied a job with the city of Madison. So the burden of proof then shifts over to the city to show that it has a business necessity for the test. And the city ends up relying very heavily on the testimony of its fire chief. The fire chief testified that very few firefighters were ever terminated or quit due to physical inability to perform the job, something that showed that the entrance level examination was a good indicator of physical ability. And of course, the city also pointed to the fact that it employed substantially more female firefighters than other departments around the country. So the court ends up saying, yeah, there's a business necessity for the test. Burden of proof shifts back to Erdman, who is required to show pretext. And Erdman attempts to show that the test is a pretext for discrimination by citing a different test. The International Association of Firefighters, IAFF's, Candidate Physical Abilities Test. The court ends up resolving the case on the basis that Erdman was unable to show that the IAFF test actually did test for the city's business necessity. I'm going to turn to the court's opinion here. The court said, quote, Erdman failed to rebut the city's argument that the IAFF test was an inferior test for its purposes. The city explained it had more stringent requirements in the ladder and pike pole events than the IAFF due to the particular needs of its fire department. The city required applicants to reposition themselves 18 inches away from the pike pole's point of contact with the ceiling before pulling the pole, because doing so would be the safest practice during an actual fire. The court says Erdman failed to rebut these justifications as a mere pretext, and therefore she loses. She was unable to show that the city's test violated the provisions of Title VII. I would expect to see more of these cases in the upcoming years. They seem to have ebbed and flowed with a great deal of regularity over time. And for whatever reason, we're in a flow right now. And just remember, these cases are going to come down to whether the city can prove, the employer can prove, a business necessity for its test. And if so, whether there's some other test out there that does not have a discriminatory effect that meets the employer's business needs. Next up is a case from Pennsylvania that I think is a very good illustration of a basic premise of labor law, and that is that the employer is obligated to comply with the greatest grant of rights to employees, no matter where that grant might be. So, for example, if we're in a state, we were talking about California a little bit earlier in this podcast. If you're in California, that means an employer, of course, has to comply with federal law, whatever the federal law might be, but also has to comply with the requirements of state law. And if state law is more generous than federal law, the employer has to comply with that state law. Or if the employer even has an ordinance or a charter provision that is more generous than federal or state law, it must comply with that. And of course, applied in a collective bargaining state, if a particular result is required by a state collective bargaining law or collective bargaining agreement, the employer must comply with that, even though it grants more rights to employees than would be the case under federal law. The greatest grant of rights to employees always sets the baseline with which an employer must comply. So what is this case in Pennsylvania all about? It involves Berks County and Teamsters Local 429. They're parties to a collective bargaining agreement that covers correctional officers and some maintenance employees. This bargaining unit has the right to arbitration as the last step in the bargaining process. That's the form of arbitration known as interest arbitration. Well, the parties are unable to reach an agreement, impasse is declared, and they head towards arbitration. Before the arbitration hearings can begin, the COVID-19 pandemic began. Well, if you can remember back to 2020, it seems like such a long time ago now, but in March of 2020, the federal government enacted the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act. The FFCRA. I'll call it the Relief Act. And that created emergency paid leave benefits that were available to employees because of the COVID-19 global pandemic. The law was only effective for a short period of time from April to December of 2020 and gave employees up to 80 hours of emergency paid time off for a qualifying reason related to COVID-19. Well, it gave most employees a right to 80 hours of paid time off. However, the Relief Act also permitted employers to exempt emergency responders from paid leave benefits. And this was, Congress said, in recognition of the fact that essential services could not be discontinued or disrupted by the lack of available employees. For what it's worth, I never really understood that. Well, what is the purpose behind that exception for emergency employees? Is the message there that you want them to come to work when they have COVID-19? Or is the message that you want them to take unpaid leave as opposed to paid leave? And if you want them to take unpaid leave, why? Why only emergency responders taking unpaid leave? Why, among other employees, are they not entitled to the paid leave? Nonetheless, that's what Congress did, so that's what the law was. Back to Berks County. Berks County took advantage of the emergency responder exception and chose to exclude jail employees from the leave provisions of the Relief Act. And its basis for doing so was that it needed sufficient staff for around-the-clock obligations that it had. And jail employees then began to file grievances that challenged the county's decision to charge their sick time or accrued vacation time to cover their absence from work, and an employment mess ensues. The result is obtained in interest arbitration over the contract. Local 429 and the Teamsters included in its proposals that it submitted to arbitration an obligation for the county to provide 80 hours of retroactive paid leave to cover COVID-19 related absences. In other words, Local 429's proposal was identical to the leave provisions of the Relief Act. A panel of three arbitrators decided the issue, and by a 2-to-1 margin, with the county dissenting, adopted Local 429's proposal. And not only did the arbitrators adopt the proposal, they required the city to provide 80 hours of paid leave for absences related to COVID-19 retroactive to March of 2020 and continuing through the expiration of the Relief Act in December 2020. The county-appointed arbitrator dissented and contended that the majority of the panel had exceeded its authority by, and I'm quoting, nullifying the statutory right and managerial prerogative of the county to exempt emergency responders from providing sick leave under the Relief Act, end quote. The county challenges the arbitrator's decision in court, and the issue winds up before the appeals court in Pennsylvania, which is known as the Commonwealth Court. And what does the Commonwealth Court say? The court says, look, the Relief Act, that's just the baseline for these sorts of benefits under COVID-19. It's very clear to us that whether this leave is paid or unpaid, that's a mandatory subject for collective bargaining. And as such, Local 429 had the opportunity to take the issue to arbitration, and the arbitrators had the jurisdiction to rule on the issue. And I'm going to quote here from the court's opinion. Quote, the award, which was issued long after the Relief Act provisions expired, did not unduly interfere with the county's managerial prerogatives, not to disrupt essential services or its statutory rights. Rather, the award simply provided paid leave benefits to jail employees. Paid leave, whether in the form of vacation, personal, or sick, is indisputably a mandatory subject of bargaining affecting the wages, hours, and other terms and conditions of employment. And that sort of issue, anything that's mandatory for bargaining, the court says, is within the jurisdiction of the arbitration panel. I want to conclude with a very unusual arbitration opinion out of the Village of Broadview, Illinois. We'll post the opinion with the show notes. I've been given permission to do so by the labor organization in question. This involves an officer by the name of Neil McMahon. And Officer McMahon learned a very, very difficult lesson in this arbitration opinion, which is, if you're going to be appealing discipline that you've received on an unrelated matter to arbitration, you better not lie on the witness stand. Okay, so what's going on here? This deals with the way the village responded to the COVID pandemic. Early on, February 2021, a commander sent members of the police department an email saying, I want to try to keep track of who's been vaccinated and who is not. Under the city policy, if you were not vaccinated, you were subject to regular testing for COVID. And if you were vaccinated, you did not have to go through that testing, of course. A few days after the commander's memo went out, Officer McMahon sent a reply saying that he had, quote, received the first shot, end quote, on February 7th, 2021. 5 or 6 weeks after that, Officer McMahon received the second dose of the vaccine, but he never informed the village that he was fully vaccinated. Even after the village issued its formal COVID policy 10 months later, and even though he understood that the policy specifically required employees to attest to their vaccination status and provide proof of vaccination or be subject to discipline, McMahon simply decided not to comply with the requirement that he provide proof of his vaccination status. Instead, he decided he was going to submit to the weekly testing required of non-vaccinated employees. So if you're wondering what in the world is going on here, you're right. Here we have someone who is fully vaccinated, who's not disclosing that fact to the employer, and wants to go through weekly testing for COVID in lieu of disclosing that fact. Here's the way the arbitrator puts what happens next. McMahon's deliberate concealment of the fact that he was vaccinated continued through his direct examination under oath at the hearing in this proceeding. when shown the village's policy and asked if he was non-vaccinated at the time and if he therefore fell under the policy's requirements for non-vaccinated employee, McMahon answered, quote, correct, end quote, to both questions. It was not until cross-examination by the village and in follow-up testimony after being recalled by the union on rebuttal that McMahon acknowledged he was, in fact, fully vaccinated at the time the village issued its COVID policy. So why does McMahon, what is McMahon's explanation to the arbitrator as to why he lied about this fact? And his answer related to the privacy of his personal health information and that he, quote, consciously chose not to comply with the requirement that he disclose his fully vaccinated status because I felt at the time I should have been able to, it was my choice to let the village know whether I was vaccinated or not. So what is the arbitrator actually hearing? What's the dispute before the arbitrator? And there's a variety of them, as you'll see when you read the arbitrator's opinion. They range from whether the employer had the management right to impose a this COVID policy that called for vaccination or testing, but also included a number of different claims by McMahon. First of all, he submitted requests for 15 minutes of overtime for each occasion when he took COVID tests. The COVID test he was not required to take. So what does the arbitrator say about that? The arbitrator says, quote, it's undisputed that McMahon purposely concealed his vaccination status from the village. I cannot agree with the union's argument that the off-shift time spent by McMahon undergoing COVID testing constituted hours worked. As McMahon knew, he was fully vaccinated and not required by the village to submit to the testing. So the arbitrator then moves on to whether or not Officer McMahon violated the testing policy. McMahon had twice been the subject of low-level disciplinary actions for his failure to comply with the weekly COVID testing requirements on other occasions. And the arbitrator ends up finding that, in fact, the city was able to establish just cause for discipline in each of those cases. The arbitrator then moves on to three different short suspensions that McMahon received from the city. Two of them dealing with the COVID testing requirements because McMahon, of course, didn't tell the village that he had been vaccinated, so he had to comply with the COVID testing requirements, and he didn't on two occasions. And then the third discipline, which was a two-day suspension, was for violation of the city's body camera policy. And the arbitrator ends up sustaining the discipline for all three of those different events. And I don't need to go over those aspects of the arbitrator's decision. Pretty standard just cause analysis, as you'll see. But I do want to read you a couple of sentences the arbitrator writes in the middle of this whole discussion that gives you a pretty good feel for the mood of the arbitrator. Quote, there is no question before me as to whether discipline would be warranted for McMahon's deliberate concealment of the fact that he was fully vaccinated. I therefore will not address that question. End quote. The arbitrator clearly ticked at the fact that a police officer would appear before him and lie in his testimony only to be tripped up in the cross-examination process. So how does this all end? We have McMahon with some sustained minor discipline as a result of this arbitrator's opinion, but with a finding by the arbitrator that he engaged in dishonesty in his testimony at the arbitration hearing. What happened post-arbitration is that the village began an internal investigation into McMahon's dishonesty, and rather than go through that, during the pandemic, we saw a bunch of cases involving public safety employees, police and fire, public safety employees lost long-term jobs because of their response to either testing requirements or vaccination requirements of their employers. It's hard for me to think of a case, though, where the loss of a police officer's job was as unnecessary as it was in this case. Well, that's it for the March 2024 edition of First Thursday. I hope to see you at one of our upcoming LRIS seminars. We have them scheduled through the end of the year. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.